Welcome to episode 54 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Perot, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks, folks, as always, for tuning in. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify. Again, anywhere you get your podcast, please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review if you haven't already done so. Joined once again by Mike Oitzman, editor of our robotics group. Mike, what's going on, man?
Hey, Steve. Happy Tuesday. It seems we skipped a week last week, but kudos to you on hosting the Collaborative Robotics event last week. It seems like it was well attended.
Yeah, no, that was a lot of fun. So for folks who may not have tuned in, Collaborative Robotics Week, I think we did 7+ hours of free collaborative robotics education for, you know, potential first-time users of cobots right now that are just looking to learn about the latest, greatest solutions that are out there that can help them with their businesses, whatever that may be. But it was a lot of fun, a lot of lessons learned. All those sessions, folks, are available on demand if you missed out or if you want to go rewatch them. Just go to roboweeks.com. You can find those. A lot of takeaways, but really a big takeaway for me was just the tremendous opportunity that what we think of right now as collaborative robotics systems have, but just the future of collaborative automation just has a tremendous upside to it. And hopefully, you know, there's many folks listening to this right now that'll help those systems and the promises come to fruition in the future. But we're also launching Robotics Engineering Week in a little while here in October. Same deal. You know, we have like 6 or 7 different sessions tackling a bunch of different topics related to robotics engineering challenges. So again, go to roboweeks.com if you guys want to check those out. But Mike, tell everybody about, we launched this a couple of weeks ago. We told folks about it a couple of weeks ago, but the ability for folks to leave us voicemails.
Right. So we've got a new feature on the website and we want to hear from you guys. Throw down a challenge, give us a question, tell us what you think. We'd love to respond to what you guys think are relevant issues today in robotics. So anything's on the table here, feedback, commentary about previous episodes, what you think is a pressing issue. And basically just on the Robot Report website, you'll find the voicemail widget on the right sidebar at the very bottom of the widgets there. Scroll down past the all of the blocks and you'll find it there. It's real simple to record a voicemail on your cell phone. If you've got the app up in your, or the website up in your browser, just click record. It uses your cell phone microphone or on your laptop or PC. You can use your computer microphone. So it's real simple. You don't have to have any sort of extra equipment to record a message to it. So we challenge you guys to give us some feedback.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you guys. Again, I think it's robotreport.com/voicemail.
There you go.
You'll see the widget right there that lets you send us a voicemail. But love to hear from you guys. Love to get you guys onto the show. But Mike, let's take a look at some of the top stories from the past week. And again, we have you guys covered from many different angles. You can check us out at therobotreport.com, roboticsbusinessreview.com, mobilerobotguide.com, and cobottrends.com. Mike, the rover, Perseverance rover, we've been tracking this thing since when did it land? And back in February, was it February?
Yeah, just after I started.
Yeah, somewhere around there. But the rover is now collecting rock samples from Mars. And wouldn't you know it, these two samples that the rover has already collected are showing signs of being in contact with water for an extended period of time on Mars. They don't know yet what time period that is. So that's something that they got to figure out still. But NASA's already come out. They're already saying, Mike, that this bolsters the possibility for ancient life on Mars.
Steve, you know, I saw a couple outlets this morning already in the social media feed that said this is evidence of life on Mars. So someone's already jumping to the conclusion that this proves that there's life on Mars.
You know, I think the unfortunate part here is, again, there's still so much that they need to examine with just these first two rock samples. But these samples, they're not going to come back to Earth for a very long time. They're saying the earliest that they'll be back is sometime in the 2030s. And that's if, you know, their return mission goes to plan, right? Obviously, this Mars 2020 mission, there's been some minor hiccups along the way, but for the most part, it's been an absolute home run, right? The return trip for these samples is probably even more ambitious, but we might not find out, you know, once the scientists get their hands on these rocks and really dig into them and take them apart, they'll certainly learn a lot more about that. But that can be, 10, 15, almost 20 years away.
Right. Well, I think that this is just one of those mission goals for this rover was to be able to collect and acquire and package up all those samples for return. So far they're hitting a home run.
But if you and I are still doing this podcast in 2030, 2035, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we'll make sure to keep the listeners up to date on what that means. But basically what happens is they found some salt in the rocks on Jezero Crater, right? And they have come to two ideas as to what that might mean. Either the salts could have formed as a result of groundwater altering the original minerals in the rock, or evaporation of liquid water resulted in these salts being left behind. But basically they're saying it is showing that there could act as some microscopic time capsules and gold mines of information regarding climate change and potential habitability of some sort of life form, I guess, on Mars. Mm-hmm. So we'll keep everybody updated. And I know they're still looking to collect some more samples. So we'll make sure to keep everybody updated on what the rover is up to next. But Mike, woke up this morning, holy moly, the funding news this morning, kind of out of control.
You think? Wow. It's what, talk about everybody sort of queuing up their stories for the same day. And of course they wouldn't have known that, but what did we add up? Well, over $500 million.
I think it's $531 million by four companies just today.
Yeah. That's amazing that money is flowing. So I guess the purse strings are open here from the investors. That I think that's good news for our industry. We've got two mobile robot companies with Locus Robots pulling in $50 million, and a Chinese company, sort of an outlier, but they're making inroads in the service robotics area. Pudu Robotics pulled in $155 million as Series C. And then, of course, our friends at Ambi Robotics with their Series A at 26, and another company that's in the space you love to talk about, Deep Route AI, with their robo-taxis and their autonomous driving solutions.
$300 million. Yeah.
Wow.
You can always count on the autonomous vehicle companies to close the biggest round, right? but it's interesting. You know, again, you've seen autonomous vehicle companies in the past with major rounds, you know, Cruise comes to mind, billion-dollar rounds, Waymo, it was a $2.5 billion, you know, last year sometime, but, you know, here's four separate companies raising a total of $531 million in a day. And in a matter of a few hours, they're all announced. So that's a pretty good day, Mike. It's like, maybe you and I are in the wrong business.
Right. Hey, I called up Jim Leifer, the CEO of Ambi Robotics, yesterday afternoon as I was preparing the story about Ambi. So let's listen to a quick clip in that conversation.
We have two products, and we've had both of those products in place since 2020.
Yeah.
So in place with globally recognized brands. And the result is, there's a lot of, I would say, when others are out looking at Series A, that's early, right? It's the A round. For us, it was much more about a growth round because we already had those customers lined up and agreements lined up. So we're deploying those systems that that we built since 2019 is when we really got started on these systems.
And so, Steve, as you heard Jim say, basically he's talking about the fact that in the 6 months, and literally those guys have been out of stealth for less than a year, they've moved from stealth to Series A in their first $50 million round. And of course, he's talking about the fact that they're not trying to figure out how to build the product. They're figuring out how to grow and deploy their solution, which, you know, we've talked about before. is going to make changes in terms of how e-commerce warehouses are able to singulate and sort items as they're going out the door.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing kind of either way you look at it, right? I think technically the company was founded, you know, in May of 2018.
Right.
But even that's just 3 years ago, right? So, you know, in the robotics world, you know, to be where they are with the commercialized product that they're scaling, you know,
right.
So we have a customer that of theirs who we talked to for an upcoming episode of the podcast, who had nothing but great things to say about Ambi Robotics and their solution. So mm-hmm. just super impressive, you know, for where they are just 3 years in. Obviously have a rock star team with Jim, with Ken, with mm-hmm. some other folks there. So Jeff Mahler, I think, is still there. So just an incredible talent that they've put together there. So I guess
we'll agreed.
Yeah. So we'll keep an eye on them, but thanks to Jim for hopping on the phone there quick
mm-hmm.
for that soundbite. Mike, one of the more interesting stories I think I've ever seen covering this space. iRobot came out, was it last week, with the new iRobot J7 Plus?
Right. Yeah. I know where you're going with this.
And you know, there's a lot of upgrades that they've made, and it seems to be a pretty good product per usual for iRobot, but they've seemingly solved the poop problem. Have you heard about this poop controversy with the Roombas? And not just the Roombas. We should clarify that. It's sort of a problem for all of the robot vacuums that are out there, but just a funny thing to talk
about. It is.
But a real issue. I mean, if you do, I know you and I talked about this off air a couple of days ago, like just if you do a quick Google search
for Steve, I lost an hour of my life watching those stupid videos on YouTube.
It's unbelievable, right? So if you do a quick, you know, robot vacuum poop search, you'll go down the rabbit hole there.
Exactly.
But it's just a gross mess that, you know, a lot of people have probably had to deal with. And just, I just sit there, and I've met Colin a couple of times and talked to him a couple of times about different stories, and he put out a great video as part of this launch, just explaining mm-hmm. the process that they went through to train their algorithms on what poop looks like and what it could look like. And
right.
I'm guessing 3D printed or somehow created 100 physical models of poop. There's iRobot employees going home and taking pictures of their actual dogs.
I guess maybe they should have talked to the guys at Ambi. Maybe they could have done it all in Sim.
Oh my God. Yeah. There you go. Sim to real technology. Really?
Yeah, maybe it would have been a little bit easier than physical models of 3D printed models of poop. Okay.
Just the lengths that they seem to have gone through. It's just hilarious to really think about the data set that they now have on all things dog poop. But trained their algorithms on 100,000 images. And we should say, I guess they trained it on the robots to avoid other things as well. Like mm-hmm. power cords and wires, which also have thrown robot vacuums for loops in the past. And if a certain area where there's wires or cords keep tricking up the Roombas, they can be designated no-go zones, basically, or keep-out zones, I think is the right term that they use. So pretty cool stuff.
Well, Steve, we don't normally do consumer reviews on this show, but I think that I scored a demo unit of the J7 Plus. So nice. I plan on, if I'm able to get my hands on a demo unit, I plan on deploying it in my house. I've got a couple of pets, no puppies. We don't have accidents, at least dog accidents. We do have hairballs. So I'm curious if it can see a hairball, that'll help me. But more than that, my dog just loves to leave all his toys all over the floor, some of which definitely will trip up the robot vacuum cleaner. So if we get to that point, I'll definitely do a story on my field testing of the J7 Plus robot.
You know, I'm interested to see how that goes. I know our colleague Dan Kara has one of the more recent Roombas, maybe another generation back, and loves the thing. Mm-hmm. I had a competitive product that was sent to me a few years ago now. And man, I tell you, this thing, I won't put the company on blast here, but I don't know if it was my the basement that I was trying, you know, a finished basement, trying to automate the cleaning down there where the kids play. And there's tables down there and there's couches and there's, you know, a music stage that we built for the kids and some, you know, just a bunch of kid toys. And this robot vacuum just got stuck every single time.
Legos, so, they don't like Legos. And I'll tell you that.
It was more getting stuck under, like, you know, we have a couple of different tables down there and it would get stuck underneath the legs, right, of the chairs, or the base legs of the table. And, you know, it just, it, if you didn't rearrange the basement room to be sort of a perfect, you know, rectangularly shaped, no clutter on the floor room, this thing just all the time, it just got stuck and would require human assistance. I think the Roombas are on a much different level, a completely different level, but interested to see how that experience goes for you. But just one more final thing on this before we get to your interview, Mike. There is a funny video on Twitter today regarding the J7 Plus Roomba. A gentleman who works in machine learning and neural networks shared a video where he shows it's obviously a previous generation Roomba, where it's getting stuck on his rug. Now he has a pretty unique looking rug,
really,
tank, right? With all sorts of different shapes and pattern and on there, in different colors on the rug. But in between each shape on the rug are these black lines. And he's saying that it's the Roomba that he's using is seeing those lines as cliffs. So it's almost getting stuck. He has this one video where the Roomba is just stuck in this one square piece of the rug. And he said, quote, "I wish they had created a diverse data set of rugs so that it didn't confuse black stripes with cliffs and I could finally get my entire house cleaned." So yes, the Roomba is trained on dog poop. Yes, it's trained on cords and wires, but you know, and this gets to a much larger discussion about edge cases in homes and other environments for robotics, but
as well as sensor selection, right? So it's about trying to create a device that has a bill of materials that is affordable,
sure,
without putting a $9,000 LiDAR laser in it, right?
Right. One of the major problems for consumer robotics right there, the cost. So
yep.
But we'll make sure to include some links there to the new Roomba in our show notes. But Mike, time to get to your interview today. I know you interviewed Tomasz Kowalkowski, co-founder and CTO of Photoneo.
Right. And this was a couple of weeks back. So I talked to him probably 3 weeks ago now. And Foot and Nail builds 3D vision solutions that include a product line of industrial 3D cameras. It's useful for all types of robot guidance in applications such as bin picking or palletizing or other types of applications, whether the cameras are fixed cameras overlooking the environment or, you know, on the actual robot arm. So they're certainly robust enough to be flung around at the end of a robot arm. And just note, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were reporting on the Intel RealSense camera chaos and product decision. We've now sort of clarified that. So as you listen to the interview, you will hear me talk to Tomas about that news at that time, which now we know has been clarified that, you know, Intel RealSense camera is going to continue. But certainly if you're an Intel RealSense camera user, I would encourage you after listening to this interview to go take a look at the Foot and Nail product line, because I think it's yet another option for all of those use cases. All right, I want to welcome Tomasz Kowalkowski to the show today. Tomasz is the CTO and co-founder of Photoneo. Tomasz, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be part of the show. And I'm thrilled for the question and the conversation.
Yeah, great. Well, I think our audience is going to be very interested to learn a little bit more about Photoneo and your solution. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how the company got started?
Yeah, all right. So we did start in about 2013. So it's quite some time we are in the market. And we started the company with the idea to create the best possible 3D vision camera or 3D camera in the world to solve a perception problem for a lot of applications. So basically, that was the starting point, and we had an unique idea how to make it happen, and unique technology that we do stand upon. And so this was the starting point, and from that we started with developing the sensoric parts that we call the eye of the machine, and then as we evolve. We understand that okay, we cannot stop with the eye. We need also to see it. You need to see the world around you. You need to understand and then react. So basically, the second phase, we invested a lot into we call brain. So to have the combination of the best sensing possible and the brain that is able to see the patterns in the data and to really do a beneficial output out of that. And then the third we call feet, then it is basically the ability to interact with the real world, real physical world, as with some kind of manipulator like the robotic arm or mobile robot. When you sense, you understand, and then you react with the real world and do the job. So basically, I would say the evolution of the company comes from the eyes and the sensoric parts. When we have the big family of products, then goes through the brain. We have a lot of solution based on AI and I would say some advanced kind of image and data geometrical processing. And then when it goes to the feed, we have complete solutions that are able to drive applications either in the automation or in the industry itself, the manufacturing and so on, and also in logistics.
Kamash, that's quite a journey that you guys have been on in almost a decade here coming up pretty soon in terms of the company and the evolution of your technology. And you mentioned a couple of things in that last statement. Can you tell us a little bit more detail about the types of robotics or automation applications that the Photoneo solution helps to solve?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in general, like we say, 3D sensing is quite a general way of capturing the data. So, so typically, a lot of applications, a lot of tasks in the real world are based on 3D, the three-dimensional world that we live in, and so on. It's very natural to sense the environment with 3D cameras. But as for the company that tries to enter the market, you need to focus. So basically, as a Photoneo, we did focus. Our range of products mostly for, I would say, smart robotics and an online inspection. So to the field, when we want to target fast applications that need, I would say, short response time that you need to see, to react really fast and basically do a reaction in terms of a physical reaction, like picking up the object and so on. Mm-hmm. And then have some kind of online inspection when you want to check the quality of all the production, and you need to have a speed to justify the cost of the solution. So these are basically sweet points for the product and for the market. So basically, most of the time it's about smart robotics or online inspection. Of course, they are. As anyway, there are applications in medical. There are applications in agriculture. There are applications in architecture or urban development, buildings, and so on. And of course, the logistics is, I would say, one of the part that fits into the first two categories, where you either need to inspect the part or need to interact with it, to sort it, to pick it out of the pallet, to pick it out of the box, and so on.
In 3D vision, obviously there's three-dimensional information in the output image from that the system delivers for processing, I guess. But are there now tasks that can be accomplished with 3D vision that weren't possible in a 2D imaging system before?
Yes. When people wanted or did want to solve a task, in many cases, the tasks are simply three-dimensional. Yes, so you need to somehow to get the third dimension even when you try to do it with the 2D. So there are a lot of clever trick the people did to solve specific applications even without the 3D camera. But in most of the cases, by the design, they somehow created a solution that is basically a 3D camera or 3D scanner of some kind. But in many cases, it's simply non-economical. And in many cases, when really think of the 2D sensing, so the information is not there. So imagine you are trying to measure something, then the only thing how you can overcome the limitation is that you somehow add the third dimension, either by a precise optics, like telemetric optics, that you made everything basically that doesn't change the direct or the size based on the distance, and do a lot of, we'll say, big investments into the hardware, into special lighting and so on. And even in some cases, even with this, it's still very challenging or almost impossible to do that, to capture. For example, one of the application of that is, I would say, the random bin picking. When you have a box full of randomly oriented part, there is simply a lot of different lighting conditions inside the box. It's very hard to do some reliable source of lighting to capture it. So bin picking, I would say, is one of the good example of an application where it's simply very hard or almost impossible to do it reliably with the 2D, and where the 3D systems thrive, and they really gives you the 3D information about the object. So all the algorithms, they don't need to think about all different kinds of lighting condition, all different kinds of scale that you, and perspective problems that you have with the 2D camera. And you simply use the raw geometry and simply have the better data that really have the information about the third dimension, and it can be all either trained or we can use it in some clever geometric algorithm.
Well, I think I wanted to ask you about the recent news that occurred this last week, and that's around the end of life for the Intel RealSense camera, which was one of the other, I would say, popular and certainly well-marketed solutions on the market. But can you share your view on you know, how the Photoneo product is similar or different to RealSense, and maybe your thoughts about why Intel is making this decision now to end of life their camera?
Yeah. Okay. So when you ask me, I don't know, two years ago, if Intel were gonna discontinue the product, I would say probably yes. My prediction would be that yes, it doesn't have sense for Intel, and I think the reason for it is, I believe that when Intel did introduce RealSense, they did want for it to be a general perception device in every customer, every consumer, a product like the notebook, laptop, phone, and so on. Mm-hmm. But as the market, I would say, didn't adopt these technologies and didn't find the use cases for the technology in this specific segments, the Intel did try to introduce the technology to basically automation and industrial environment. But the problem is that they invested extreme amount of money into something that is then basically sold for a small for $100. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that they were burning a lot of money on something that in any universe would not give them the returns they invested into the technology, because they was not able to go into the volumes. So basically, most of the people that do use RealSense for industrial automation, they take the advantage of the consumer product going into industrial environment, but there was no consumer backing of that product in the mass volume market. So it's simply this model from the business perspective doesn't add up. And this is the risk of doing that. If you say, okay, this is the consumer technology I'm going to use, you are risking that this will happen. Basically, in any type of consumer technology, they don't have the high volume backing. And from the perspective of, I would say, technological difference, the RealSense offers much smaller accuracy and the resolution, because of course it's built for a different environment, and also the important part of the story is they did optimize the system for a wide variety of applications, but like it also targeting the applications that are like people counting and I would say perspective thing like skeleton tracking and so on, that simply this vast amount of applications make it quite general product, but it was not perfect in each category. So it typically has the most of the family or almost all products they have lower resolution. So it was quite, for example, when you take some of the latest one, it was quite challenged by the tough environment, like a lot of ambient light and so on. Mm-hmm. So when you compare it to our sensors, we built sensors that are reliable and offer very high high accuracy and resolution, and that we can rely on even in challenging environment with high ambient light, with that are in the motion, because as for example our range of motion cam technology, there is literally no motion blur, so you can move it really fast. While even for the real sense, when you move the object or you move the camera, then you have a blurry image. So they are in the technological point of view, I would say in every category, we are better. Of course, when you talk about okay, but there was a good value per money ratio. Yes, that was true because Intel did lose money selling every piece to the customer, so yes, the value was very good because it was not from the business perspective it doesn't have sense to have such a device, and there was the risk and it backfires.
Well, and let's talk about your marketing for a minute in comparing to a couple of things that you just described. So you market your solution as high speed 3D imaging. And I would imagine that's sort of twofold, both in the sort of the image processing part of that that happens in real time, pretty much, right? And then also in maybe as you described, the blurry images. So the shutter speeds that are possible to be able to do image capture that provides a clear image to actually get and extract relevant information, especially in, say, for AMR guidance or robot end of tooling guidance as well, where you might be taking imaging on the fly while the arm is moving potentially to drive it. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, the high speed aspect of your system and why that's important in its application.
Yeah, so when you talk about the high speed, and the important part of the story is that our motion cam is not like a good only just a good implementation of the technology, but there are fundamental I would say ways how you can sense 3D data, and there is of course like the time of flight when you sense basically time when the photons go back. There is like something called structured light in the projection sites. Like you have some kind of random pattern that you sense it or you throw into the scene and you try to sense it on the other side, which typically have a problem with resolution, resolution capability, because the resolution is limited by the number of dots and you need a much higher resolution on the camera side to retrieve it. Then of course with the time of flight you have problem with the speed of flight and to reach very small details, and typically when you want to increase the resolution you get a hit in Z resolution, and when you decrease the resolution in XY you can have somehow better Z resolution, but it's hard to maintain a good XYZ resolution out of it. And in our case, we basically, because when you think about structured light as typically used for metrology, then you use a series of images one after another, encoding some very precise illumination patterns, and then reconstructing it from several frames. We're able to get per pixel 3D measurements that are very high and very high accuracy. But the problem is that you need several images, which means that if something moves, that you will be blurry. But we was able to do a technology that is able, with some clever tricks on the level of the sensor, we're able to not encode it into the projection, we're encoding into the sensoric part. Mm-hmm. And doing this, what was before possible with several images, we're able to squeeze into one. And this is the magic that happens. It's fundamentally the optimal way how to sense that information. And we don't waste the resolution for that, as is, for example, in this random dot that you need to have because of the Nyquist-Shannon theorem, much more of the sensor resolution to retrieve the depth information. In our case, you don't. We overcome that because of the method itself. So with that, we have the comparable quality to these metrology devices, but in one frame and with very high resolution and per pixel measurement. So when we say we have this kind of resolution, we're really measuring it. It's not an extrapolation. So in this case, we simply have much more, I would say, advanced and much more clever technique how to retrieve the data that is more efficient. So the resources that we use are efficiently used to come with a very high resolution 3D output. And because of this, we're able to use the system in applications that you need to have accuracy, but you have only small amount of time. You need to react fast. Or as you said, the hand is in motion, the sensor is in motion. And with our technology, the fundamental thing is this, that I said, it's no motion blur. So we can sense a spinning fan without distortion on the level of blur, which you even get with the global shutter cameras. We have, for example, 10 milliseconds shutter time. You will still have blurry image if the object is fast. Mm-hmm. Motion cam, you don't have that because we use some laser sweeping through the scene. And typically, when you want to do it with competing technologies like time of flight or as I said, this structured pattern sensors, you need to lower down shutter time to very small numbers. But you can only do that by making very strong flashes, which is typically impossible with lasers to do a flashes that powerful hit the whole scene. This is simply very very complicated or almost impossible. So they are not able to do that typically. So that's one of our strong advantage that we are able to capture with very high accuracy. With very and also very very fast moving objects.
Interesting. And so I think that from that response, I think I understand a little bit better again why your solution is optimized for in the industrial applications, which again you've already always targeted as the end game for your solution. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation what I've described as the holy grail application of bin picking or debulking applications, which have, you know, robotics have struggled to solve in a robust way outside of laboratory and actually do it in production, right? And I think we've arrived now with your solution at the opportunity to drive any robotic arm now to do a bin picking by any robotic arm, whether they're collaborative or industrial robot arms now to do debulking applications. Again, talk to us briefly about, you know, the evolution of bin picking and 3D vision and why we now are, you know, at a place where we can actually achieve with repeatability and you know, the accuracy to actually do those types of applications in production.
All right. So with bin picking, I would say the biggest or the hardest part of bin picking is this hard problem by design. So there are a lot of challenging parts. And the one thing is you have all different kind of materials. And for some reason, people love shiny materials. So it's much more complicated than that. So typically we have, I would say, you see 100 of varied shaped objects that are typically shiny, draw into the bin that interfere one with each another. Ideally, they are also stacked together. Mm-hmm. They are one on another, and so on. And as a human being, when you want to take the part out of the bin, you don't typically think about that. You use your vision and your haptics to get it out. So your powerful brain. So you pick one. You do a motion that is that you understand the shape of the object, and you try somehow to pick it because you understand that if you pick it this way, it will stuck with the other. So you are doing all of these kind of computations in real time to do that. So if you want to overcome, you need to solve all of these small problems. Mm-hmm. One of these, for example, gripper itself. This is one thing that a lot of our customers are typically, or they don't think about that as a big of a problem. And they say, okay, so there's a gripper. The gripper is very important. It limits how the robot can approach the parts. Mm-hmm. And as we, for example, made a lot of installation, we gather a lot of experience about how the gripper should be designed. And in a typical application, when we collaborate with our partners, with our customers, we try to drive them through this process, to help them, to consult with them. And we have quite a good and a big database of grippers and gripper designs that we used in the past, and they did work for the application itself. So I would say that the gripper part is important. Of course, the sensing, the data. In many cases, we were able to overcome other competitors in the field because we simply had better data. So better data means that the problem that is harder by itself is even harder than when you have a data that have a lot of noise, that have a lot of inaccuracies. So by I would say combining our experience from the brain part and the eye part, we're able to solve this thing together. So sometimes we optimize scanning algorithms to for example work better with the shiny part to filter out ambient light. Was something that was, I would say, very unique for our sensor to be able to scan very high, even several meter square objects, even with very strong ambient sunlight or very strong ambient light, like even the 20,000 lux or something like that, which is I would say very, very unique. So this industrial environment, in many cases, this is the case, like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 lux is normal in a very lit industrial hall. So we need to do that. Then the part with the planning of the motion, you need to plan the motion in a way that you pick up the part that is not hit by another one. You need to understand that, okay, this part is on top of this one, and you need to make some kind of heuristic to say, okay, this is the one that I want to pick that will not try to lift the whole box with it. Mm-hmm. And for all this, you need a lot of processing, and you need to go back and forth from the sensoric part with the intelligence on top of that, and also with the training. When, for example, you're picking the objects that you never seen before, then we have a train network for recognition of objects of different kind. Yeah, so we are able, for example, to train on some quite general objects, and then able to identify. And as I said, you need also to solve, okay, where's the center of gravity of the objects? If you want to pick it, you don't want to typically pick it at the edge of the object because it will fall. Or mm-hmm. when you have a vacuum gripper, the point where we need to pick the object, it's not easy to say that. So all of that, mm-hmm. I would say, hundreds of problems it are together. You need to solve one by one, and it takes time. So gladly, or as a good thing, we did take the time and we saw that in our solution. So we can offer it to our customers.
Well, I think just to summarize that conversation from what I just heard you say, I mean, it begins with perception. So being able to perceive the scene, to be able to see and perceive, you know, the stacking of parts is where it begins. Because unless you can make that determination, you can't even get to the second step in that workflow, which is how do you do the approach with the gripper and find the appropriate pick point, unless you actually have a chance of understanding what you're looking at, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, One last question for you today, then. It's been a very interesting conversation, and I've learned quite a bit about the solution that you have brought to market. But bringing again to light the news about RealSense and the fact that RealSense has been implemented in a variety of AMRs today, I can think of at least a handful of AMRs that have deployed it. Is Photonail 3D imaging a good solution to help guide an AMR? And maybe there's two applications here that I have in my head. One is for the obstacle avoidance and actual navigation of an AMR. And the other one would be for a mobile manipulator, you know, that's placed on top of an AMR. It seems like it would also be a good solution for guiding the operation of that mobile manipulation for the robot arm to be able to perceive and pick up things that it sees in the environment to do machine tending or other types of operations.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever you need, I would say, to do a delicate work, you need to have high resolution and accuracy. There is a time where the motion cam or the scanner can help you do that. For the general navigation, you typically use I would say LIDARs or different techniques to guide you in the environment. But they have, I would say, you can get in the level of maybe five centimeters with the LIDARs to go somewhere, maybe better, depends on the stack. But when you need to have a delicate navigation, then yes, the motion cam can help. For example, with the collaboration of the robotic arm, you're able to do the picking and tending with the robot itself. Or if you need to precisely navigate the robot into a position or pick something like a pallet from the ground, yes, you can use our sensor for that. I would say for the general navigation, I think the LIDARs do the job quite well, and they also provide quite a good track of safety certified products. But whenever you need to do the delicate work, yes, we have a solutions that have very very high accuracy and resolution that can help you do it. So as you said, it for many mobile robots that are into RealSense implemented, yes, I did know a few, but I would say mostly they're used for detection of, for example, pedestrian or objects that are outside of the reach of the LIDAR. Typically, you have just one plane. So yes, for these applications, also the motion cam can be used. So that would be a good application for the motion cam. But as I said, for every delicate task, this is a way where you can use a motion cam.
Well, Tomasz, very interesting conversation. I want to thank you for joining us today. And I'll put a link in the show notes to your solution and your complete lineup. You've got a whole lineup here of products, a whole variety of cameras for a variety of different applications. And I think our audience will be very interested to learn more about your solutions in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike. And it was a pleasure to have a talk with you and to discuss all these topics.
Awesome. Yeah. One more quick thing, Mike, before we sign off here. Do you remember that the fire at the Ocado warehouse a couple months ago? Was it
July? Right? Yeah. Over in England, I believe, right?
Yeah. Over in England. So this is the second fire that they've had that was caused by robots. This one in particular, apparently three robots in its ASRS system collided with each other and caused the fire. Well, Ocado came out this week and finally revealed the extent of the financial damage that resulted from the fire. And it's just, it's kind of unbelievable to me, I think. So they came out, Ocado, and said it lost 300,000. So maybe Ocado online grocer over in the UK, very, very large online grocer. Ocado said it lost 300,000 orders as a result of the fire. And its business was affected by about 10 million pounds, which is
wow,
the equivalent of 14 million US dollars. Plus, they lost another 10 million pounds in stock and other write-offs. So insurance did cover about half of those losses. So the overall net loss that Ocado suffered, you know, direct loss to its business was about $14 million. But this is the incredible part to me. So this was part of their quarterly earnings statement or call that they had. For this latest quarter, Ocado said its weekly orders increased 1.4% to 338,000 orders per week.
So they lost a week's, yeah, they lost a week's worth of orders in that fire, sounds like.
A week's worth, almost a week's worth of orders. Yeah. Result of the fire, which is just incredible, right? It's just absolutely incredible. We often write about or talk to other folks in the industry. You hear about downtime and how important, you know, it is to minimize the downtime. Mm-hmm. This is crazy. You know, Ocado is a massive company and, you know, have obviously, they're weathering this fire, but, you know, just incredible that something like this, where three of the robots collided, could affect the business that much.
Well, you know, and who knows, we don't know how much of the inventory stack, you know, Ocado is a cube-based ASRS system, so everything's stacked in the cube. If it's a LiPo battery was part of the, you know, the fire, those fires burn hot and hard and you know, probably destroyed a lot of product in the stack. But who knows if how do they recover product out of the stack with the damage to the array. So, right. So a lot of questions. I have a lot of questions about the implementation, but it's, you know, it's good to hear that they've recovered, and I'm sure that they'll take measures not to let that happen again.
Now, it is interesting. You said you have a lot of questions. We've reached out to Ocado and some of its competitors, right? So Ocado, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mike, but they make their own ASRS system, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're using their own system that they developed.
Right.
They're not using a third party system. So again, they haven't responded to our, or they have responded to our inquiries and said that they're not looking to talk. Some of the competitors, I think we reached out to AutoStore just to try to glean any sort of information. You know, you touched upon the batteries, you know, what exactly happened here, you know, for folks who are listening that are working in ASRS systems, you know, there could be something to learn about this, right? I mean, if this is a third party company, you know, system that caused two fires, I can't imagine that third party company would be doing too well, right? I don't think Ocado would be a customer for much longer, but this is their own technology, their own system, but just amazing.
Well, and I was just going to add as a sidebar, I'm going to be out in Las Vegas next week for the grocery shop trade show, which is the sort of the premier trade show now in North America for all of the grocery store business related technology. I believe there's a half dozen robotic vendors that are going to be there that I'm going to talk to. So I'll come back from that show with some more news and information, not about Ocado, but about this market as a whole. So we can talk about that in the next week or two.
Awesome. Yeah, look forward to that. And folks, that's going to do it for episode 54. Of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Tomasz Kowakowski of Photoneo for joining the program. Don't forget, we talked about this off the top of the program here. We want to get you guys involved in the show. You can now leave us a voicemail that we can play on an upcoming episode of the Robot Report podcast. You can ask Mike or I a question, leave us a comment about a previous interview or a previous episode, something silly that we've certainly said on the show. Anything you want, anything's on the table. We want to make this show more interactive, make it like a true radio program going forward. So if you want to do that, just go to therobotreport.com/voicemail. You'll see the SpeakPipe widget right there. You can leave a voicemail right from your phone, right from your browser. Super easy to do. The quality's terrific. And so we hope to get those voicemails coming in. So thanks, folks. And new episodes of the podcast drop each week. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify. You get the idea. Please subscribe. Leave us a rating. If there's anyone else out there that you want Mike or I to interview on an upcoming episode of the show, just reach out to us and let us know. On behalf of Mike Oitzman and the entire Robot Report team, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next week.